I'm going to call it an incremental development in the Hillary email scandal. The Clinton staffer, Brian Pagliano, the guy who set up her private server, his emails are missing.
Again, Yahoo says that state-sponsored hackers are behind this attack. Exactly which country?
WikiLeaks posting thousands of leaked emails between top Democratic Party officials, some of which suggest the DNC favored Hillary Clinton.
It's hard to get away from the fact that for all the sophistication we humans have shown in developing new technology systems, we've got a surprisingly poor record when it comes to making them secure. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. Today on the program, issues of digital security. We'll look at the role AI, artificial intelligence, might play in fending off hackers. We'll hear about a new and alarming report on the safety of e-health records. And we'll deal with an uncomfortable truth.
We're really in an era of capitalist surveillance. And these tech companies themselves, you know, really make a lot of money through targeted advertising. And their whole business model is kind of essentially built on a program of surveillance. As individuals who sign up to use products and services by these companies, we've really made somewhat of a Faustian pact with them.
And that Faustian pact means major email providers like Yahoo and Google monitor the contents of your emails on an ongoing basis. Yes, your emails. And they continue to do it because there's profit in doing so. That was Dr. Monique Mann, by the way, from the law faculty at the Queensland University of Technology. First, though, let's talk health. A recent report called Flying Blind suggests that Australia's health sector is plagued by fragmented data. Here's one of the study's authors, David Jonas, speaking on RN's health report.
If you look at what we call points of service, which really is where health data is collected or produced every single day of the week, whether that's in the GP's environment, pathology, imaging, surgery, hospitals, allied health, each of those is really effectively locked up in their own little silo of the provider. Small amounts are provided up to people like the AIHW for certain amounts of reporting and research. Everything else is locked up. We really look at the attitudes of consumers, as we point to in our report. Something like 91% of consumers are happy to have their data joined up, really for a whole range of benefits related to themselves, to health research, and to planning and management of the system.
David Jonas from Capital Markets Cooperative Research Centre. That silos might need to be broken down in the Australian health sector is fair enough, but new research from the United States should sound a warning about the need for better security. James Scott is a senior fellow with the Institute for Critical Infrastructure Technology in Washington, and his latest report is titled Your Life Repackaged and Resold. His report looks at the so-called deep web, that part of the internet that's not available through regular search mechanisms and which is often used by criminals. On the deep web, says James Scott, there's a thriving market for e-health-related data.
Health sector silo within critical infrastructure is vulnerable to attack because the treasure troves of information and data are virtually completely unprotected. A hacker with even a novice capability can go in, create a diversion with DDoS or ransomware, map the network, find out where the vulnerable devices are, set up a beachhead for future attack, or set up some type of remote access Trojan so they can go in and out of the system undetected. And also, it's very easy to exfiltrate undetectable packet sizes of data. We are kind of seeing that health sector organizations are beginning to at least layer their security. That way, when a hacker gets through one layer, they have to overcome another. You know, and they're starting to use multi-factor authentication. They're starting to use things like user behavior analytics to detect abnormalities in user behavior in case someone does have their user credentials compromised by an outside source.
How extensive is the deep web black market for electronic health records? Give us a bit of an idea of scale.
It's massive, and there are markets and forums, buyers and sellers for just about every appetite. And electronic health records are extremely valuable because they have complete information and many times including the social security number. So what can be done is obviously the first layer that the victim will experience would be identity theft. And that's easy for any novice on the deep web to start to capitalize off of. But I mean, that's the least of the concerns. There's so many other things that are happening now. They're taking that information and giving identities to victims of human trafficking. Illegal immigration, you know, where someone goes and commits a crime and then that individual has to then prove that their identity was compromised. And it's extremely taxing. And especially when you're on the deep web and you're looking at the new uses for information and the new stalker forums, they have stalker forums where they can localize in your market. If you're a sexual predator, for example, or a pedophile, you can purchase 14-year-old's electronic health record with accompanying social media footprint for real-time surveillance. That's the kind of thing that we're experiencing now. That's where this is headed.
And is part of the problem here that while healthcare organizations haven't kept pace with security, that other parts of the economy and society have? Are they particularly vulnerable simply because they're an easy target, given that the others have strengthened their procedures?
Yeah, they are targeted more because, well, previously the financial sector was most targeted. Then they shored up their vulnerabilities and became more difficult to penetrate. So adversaries made a lateral move over and picked the next easiest and most vulnerable industry, and that is the health sector. And until the health sector becomes just as difficult as the financial sector to breach, they're going to continue to be victimized, and the actual individuals who have their records exfiltrated will continue to be re-victimized and re-victimized.
You mention in your report that the FBI argues that healthcare-related identity theft is much harder to detect, taking almost twice as long as identity theft in other areas. Why is it so difficult by comparison?
I think that with having your credit card stolen or something like that, there are alerts that the financial sector has in place if there's some type of abnormality in the geography of your purchasing. So with the health sector, those protocols are not so readily in place. So you can go on and on after a hospital's breached. And maybe you're looking in the wrong place for identity theft. You're looking for loans that are being taken out in your name, or you're looking in obvious places as opposed to someone using your identity to purchase large amounts of Ritalin at multiple pharmacies.
And in the United States, as I understand it from your report, a healthcare provider isn't obliged to report a breach unless that breach involves 500 patients' records. So there'll be a lot of people out there who would have had their records stolen or hacked into, and perhaps they're never told about that.
Especially at the smaller doctors' offices in rural areas and lower income areas. The thing is, most of these physicians don't even know that they've been breached. There's someone sitting on the backbone of their network just exfiltrating data at will. That's how it is across the board. Hospitals, insurance companies, they're breached. And there could be multiple adversaries within their network. But unless they have layered security that not just, you know, detects and responds, but predicts with artificial intelligence now, they're not going to be able to detect them.
And the individual victims of electronic health record theft, tell us about those. I mean, what sort of consumer protections are there, say, in the United States in this area?
Not many. They will typically get identity theft protection from the hospital. But now there's a lot of discussions around class action lawsuits and things like that. And the downside is insurance companies have money, so they can make payouts. But hospitals, for the most part, they're basically nonprofits. We're not for profits. So, you know, we're not seeing a lot of movement that's proactive by these organizations to shore up their vulnerabilities.
Just take us back a bit to the deep web markets themselves. I mean, how sophisticated are they as black markets? How do they actually function?
They function just like eBay. They have their own review systems. You can leave reviews. They have star ratings. They're just as review-driven as eBay, Amazon, you know, any of these vendor-type platforms. You have the marketplaces and forums that are easy to get into, and then you have some that you have to have a referral into. You'll pay more, but it's a better or easier customer experience.
So I guess the question is, if it's possible for an organization like yours to do research into this area and to at least start to identify some of the marketplaces, why is it so difficult for authorities to put a stop to this?
I think they're trying. The problem is when you have local law enforcement, for example, who tries to investigate a local breach at a hospital, or it's so easy to see that they're a police, it kind of makes everyone in the forum go dark. And so even with researchers like us, everything stops until that group goes to a different forum because they don't know what they're doing. And it really becomes complicated when you have multiple local law enforcement agencies in one forum investigating a breach. The FBI, their method is to discover who one of the vendors is and then turn them so that they can use those credentials to investigate. So I think that law enforcement is becoming better at investigating, but this is a completely different skill set than you learn in college or anything like that. It's kind of like a cyber technical social engineering aspect that you have to really become good at to be able to go in and investigate without being detected.
James Scott from the Institute for Critical Infrastructure Technology in Washington. And on the Future Tense website, you'll find a link to their report. Let me give you the title again. It's called Your Life, Repackaged and Resold. Think of Las Vegas and security, and you're likely to think of bouncers. But once a year, they stage a major international security event in the casino capital called the Black Hat Cybersecurity Conference. Now, this year's Grand Cyber Challenge involved artificial intelligence.
So what we'll see here today is much more than the world's first all-machine hacking tournament. The lessons learned could lead to a world where computer viruses, malware, and attacks are discovered in a matter of weeks, days, or even seconds. Right now, it takes a few...
And one of the attendees was a guy named Matt DeVoe, who's the managing director and global lead for cyber defense for a company called Accenture. I got in touch with Matt to find out more about the challenge, and I began by asking him to set the scene, to give us a brief description of how we currently defend our computer systems against cyber attack.
Today, we've relied primarily on standard technologies, right? We've taken a very perimeter-driven approach for a number of years in which we say we will protect ourselves from threats on the internet by installing firewalls and gateways and proxies and things that protect us from the attackers that take place. And then on the chance that something gets within our network, is a virus or has malware component associated with it, we will use antivirus software that is signature-based, right? It is dependent on knowing that a piece of software is bad in order to identify the fact that it is at risk and needs to be remediated. So that has really driven security, you know, over the past decade plus, is this perimeter mentality. We will build walls, we will build firewalls, and then we will rely on signature-based technologies to help us in the event that there is a piece of software or an intruder that gets in on the inside.
And that's still a very human-centric approach, isn't it, despite the application of technology?
We've been able to automate the process to a certain extent, but you know, you do still rely on humans making that determination as to whether something is good or bad. A lot of times they might be able to automate it based on other known bad pieces of software or traits within the software that are indicative that it's from the same malware family, et cetera. But we really still are fairly dependent on the humans being a key component in the process.
Now, the recent Black Hat Cybersecurity Conference that was held in the United States saw an interesting hacking competition held involving artificial intelligence and cybersecurity. Could I get you to give us a bit of an overview of that particular competition?
Yes, so it was a competition that was held by DARPA in the United States, which is our Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. DARPA is looking at handling, you know, very hard challenges from a technical perspective and trying to figure out the art of the possible. They have for a couple of years now run this cyber grand challenge, which was basically, can you create systems that are automated, that can operate without human intervention and engage in attack and defense activities? So the culmination of that was a contest that took place at the DEF CON hacking conference right after Black Hat in Las Vegas, in which they put the front runners from this contest in an environment together with no human beings, completely air gap, no intervention whatsoever, and let them engage in this network attack and defend activity against each other.
So these were automated anti-hacking systems trying to look for vulnerabilities in each other, is that correct?
Yeah, they were looking for vulnerabilities in the network that they were plugged into, right? So they create during these capture the flag contests a network that has nodes on it that have certain vulnerabilities that might be known or unknown. And what the systems were doing is they were proactively on their own, based on the programming and heuristics that their developers had put in them, they were searching that network, finding vulnerabilities that could be exploited, exploiting those vulnerabilities, and then patching the vulnerability. And the reason that you patch it is with capture the flag, you want to make sure that you maintain possession of the flag. So you're trying to fix the problems that might lead, you know, a competitor from gaining access to the same system. And as with any contest, it's no fun unless you can watch the score. So they actually devised a means in which the score was being kept on this air gap network, and then the results were being burned to a Blu-ray drive, and that Blu-ray disc was being transited between the air gap network and the audience network via a robotic arm. So it really was, you know, a technical air gap. The only way to get data across was by burning it to this Blu-ray and moving it with the robotic arm. That allowed for the audience to watch what was happening on the network in quasi-real time. There was a slight delay given the data latency issues. But otherwise, the machines were acting completely autonomously on this network.
And what was the result?
The result was fascinating from my perspective as someone who has been in the security field for 20 years and feels fairly in tune with the latest developments. And I feel like we made a great leap forward in the capability that the machines have from a machine learning automation, kind of automated defense perspective. From my perspective, they performed at a level that I wouldn't expect we would have achieved for another 5 or so years. So it was one of those technology surprise type issues in which I was legitimately impressed with the activities that this contest was able to engage in.
A simple question: why would it be better to have an automated anti-hacking system rather than one that has some degree of human intervention?
The benefit is the system can obviously learn at a level that is much faster and much more comprehensive than a human being from an expertise perspective, or what they're able to observe on the network by way of behavior that's anomalous or indicative of, you know, something being bad. The other aspect is it's just a scale. We've seen over the years automation and network attack. The attackers are writing tools that allow them to do real-time morphing of the code that they're using to prevent their signature from being detected. They are automating and introducing kind of machine speed components on the attack side. So it's essential that we need to include those components on the defense side as well.
Are there risks, though?
I think the risks are, you know, obviously that as you improve the automated defenses, you're also going to see a correlation in the improvement of automated attack. And as I mentioned, as part of this contest, to engage in the capture the flag activities, the systems were first attacking the nodes on the network. The potential that you have is that some of these technologies will be developed, unleashed, either with unclear intent that kind of morphs and causes some sort of damage, or are released by actors in which they say, you know, my intent is I want the system to figure out a way to go after a national power grid. And it's got no more context other than that. And then the machines try and learn and achieve that target. And there's no way to kind of trace it back to its cause or its root. The autonomy introduces great advantages, but it also introduces great risk in that we are giving up some control to the machines as part of this process on both the attack and the defense side.
Are there ways to prevent the misuse of this type of technology?
I think that's very difficult. As we've seen over time with technological advancement, it's very difficult to put the genie back in the bottle once it gets out. You know, we had a lot of governments trying to control encryption 20 years ago unsuccessfully. There are other examples of technology that has proliferated. I think what we might see is more the equivalent of a non-proliferation type monitoring, watching for and monitoring the research that takes place to make sure that we understand and can place some constraints on it kind of while it's in development. I think that is probably the best that we can hope for at this point. I think it is inevitable, and I think it is a good thing from the perspective of defense, right? We've shown that defense does not scale from a cyber defense perspective. At least here in the United States, we talk about the skills shortfall and the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of jobs that can't be filled on the cyber defense side. We've seen that the attackers are able to automate the attack. So we need to have these technologies that automate the defense as well, if we're going to be able to scale and keep systems secure over the long term.
Well, Matt DeVoe, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Edward Snowden, let me start with you. What quality, what characteristic defines a whistleblower? What makes someone such as yourself take such massive risks?
I think it ultimately comes down to you see a structure of laws where the legality of the times are becoming more and more divorced from the morality of our daily lives, the daily decision-making, the sort of values we hold. And when we have that, you ultimately have to make a choice about what do you have a greater commitment to, the law or to justice?
Assumptions are often problematic, of course. But one might have assumed that after Edward Snowden revealed the mass surveillance undertaken in democratic countries by democratic governments, that some of that behaviour might have tailed off. But according to Dr. Monique Mann, there's still much to be concerned about. Dr. Mann is a lecturer in the School of Justice in the Faculty of Law at the Queensland University of Technology.
First of all, there's a lot, I think, that we potentially don't know, and the mass indiscriminate surveillance by the US and Five Eyes partners was really brought to light by the Snowden revelations, but we see sort of more recent indications that these types of programs or other forms of surveillance are continuing. So, for example, one of the key revelations from Snowden was the NSA and also GCHQ program of intercepting undersea fibre optic cables.
GCHQ being the British equivalent of the NSA, the National Security Agency in the United States.
Yes, the main sort of eavesdropping agency you could describe it as. And it was only recently decided by the UK Investigatory Powers Tribunal that the UK security services, including MI5 and MI6, conducted this surveillance regime without proper safeguards or oversight for almost the past two decades. So that really shows that these are long-standing surveillance programs.
And this is the British agency spying on their own people.
It's intercepting fibre optic kind of cables or the backbone of the internet. And through the Five Eyes intelligence partnership, this information is shared between Five Eyes partners.
And Five Eyes partners being Britain, Australia, Canada, New Zealand and the United States.
Yes, exactly.
Now, they're countries that have a strong democratic tradition. The fact that they are still involved in this kind of mass surveillance of people and their communications, ordinary people and their communications, to some people will seem quite extraordinary.
It's certainly extraordinary and it's certainly problematic from a human rights and privacy perspective. And so, for example, the recent case brought by Privacy International to the UK Investigatory Powers Tribunal, you know, really showed that the collection of bulk communication data sets and bulk personal information or bulk personal data sets was really quite problematic according to human rights principles, particularly in the European Union.
One of the other privacy concerns that you've highlighted is the fact that these government surveillance organisations are also continuing to put pressure on technology companies, on service providers, to do their bidding for them. Could I get you to tell us about some of the recent incidents there?
Well, Snowden's revelations particularly highlighted that tech companies, including Apple, Microsoft and Google, were, you know, really accused of complicity in state surveillance programs. But most recently, it was reported by Reuters that Yahoo scanned millions of emails looking for a digital signature at the request of US security agencies.
And there's also been a recent incident in New Zealand.
Yes, so that was very recently, a New Zealand tech company, Endus, it was revealed they actually played a key role in creating the Medusa system that was used by GCHQ to harvest data and communications as part of the Tempora program.
Now, there has been some pushback, though, hasn't there, in recent times from these technology companies to these kind of requests from government for assistance with surveillance?
Certainly. There have been tensions with government agencies, attempting to deputise or lean on tech companies to either provide data or build backdoors kind of into security features to unlock encrypted information. The two kind of key examples of this that come to mind are the Apple FBI case, in which Apple refused to create a backdoor in the security features to unlock an encrypted iPhone. And the other example would be the Microsoft case, where Microsoft has refused to hand over email content stored in Irish data centres, arguing this would constitute an impermissible extraterritorial search by the FBI.
Now, we know about those two cases, but it's difficult to know, isn't it, how much leaning is going on, how much pressure is being put on these organisations, simply because they're often not allowed to actually detail in any way that they've had a request from government.
So certainly national security letters, which kind of these warrants or requests for information from tech companies quite often come with gag orders prohibiting the actual disclosure that these requests are being made.
Many people would hear that and think that's a big tick for these technology companies, but they're not clean skins at all when it comes to surveillance, are they? I mean, tell us about corporate surveillance, and particularly in relation to people's emails.
We're really in an era of capitalist surveillance, and these tech companies themselves, you know, really make money, a lot of money through targeted advertising, and their whole business model is kind of essentially built on a program of surveillance. As individuals who sign up to use products and services by these companies, we've really made somewhat of a Faustian pact with them. So tech companies, including Yahoo, Google, and also Facebook, have reported scanning email communications for the purposes of developing targeted advertising, which is also known as online behavioral advertising.
So if I have a Gmail account or if I have a Yahoo email account, the chances are the company is actually reading or scanning at least my emails on a regular basis.
Yes, it's listed in the Google Terms of Service. And really what they're trying to do is learn information about you, so what you like, more broadly, your online activities, aggregating this in some circumstances with other data about you, particularly with the view to sell you something or predict what you're likely to buy. But it's not only email scanning. It also occurs through third-party cookies tracing your web browsing history. And an example of that is Google's ad tracking network, DoubleClick.
Now, people who are concerned about this or who realise that this is going on, some of them use encryption services to try and secure their email communications. But how effective are they? Because we have seen several governments pushing back, haven't we, against encryption.
There have been discussions more broadly in relation to criminalising encryption or other forms of privacy-enhancing technology. However, encryption, particularly end-to-end public key encryption, is a very effective kind of method of concealing the content of your communications, as it allows only the sender and receiver to read the content of messages as it's converted, information is converted into a secret code.
And there are encryption services that people can use that don't require a great deal of technical expertise. So encryption is open now to many ordinary people using email or other forms of communication.
Certainly, encryption is now mainstream, and there are example services such as the messaging app Signal, or for example, email provider ProtonMail, that not only encrypt information, they also implement principles of privacy by design, which means that they actually collect or can access very little information about you.
So encryption is one tool that people can use to deal with this situation. But if you don't use encryption, there's not much people can do, really, is there, given that these main service providers actually make their money from this type of surveillance? They're unlikely to change their practices anytime soon, are they?
Well, in my view, if you aren't paying for a service, then you yourself are the product. And here we see this kind of Faustian pact being made on this business model of capitalist surveillance. But at the same time, trust is also very important, and there are numerous privacy trust measures that are compiled that also demonstrate that there's a clear business case for companies to invest in matters of privacy. So, for example, we also see an emerging market for privacy. A key example of that is subscriptions for virtual private networks. With that said, though, this is a very complex area with numerous competing interests and investments in personal data. But ultimately, in my view, these service providers have a duty to promote information self-determination or individual control or autonomy of their personal information as a fundamental right. I think also there's an argument to be made here for service providers in particular to be more transparent and clear about their practices, and also a more active role by regulators such as the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner in terms of developing guidelines, assessing compliance and providing oversight.
Lecturer in Law, Monique Mann from the Queensland University of Technology. Thanks to my co-producer here at Future Tense, Edwina Stott, and sound engineer Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. I'll join you again next week. Until then, cheers.